Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, The Rings of Power premieres. We're joined by CEO of Marcus Theaters to talk about an awesome initiative kicking off this weekend, and we do the Kevin Smith tier list.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 228 of Real Blend, a podcast that's not saying anything about you now, okay? They're talking about fictional characters.
Fictional characters!
Am I getting through to you at all?
That was very good!
Thank you.
What the F is the internet?
That was an actual performance!
They're not saying anything about you now.
Fictional character.
That's what I want to scream at most people on the internet that are arguing about anything.
That's like the only line from that I could read that's like safe to say on the podcast.
You want to go ahead and do Jay's rap from the beginning outside of the store for us real quick?
I will leave that out of it.
Okay. Well, it just starts with a great word.
My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, and I am the co-host of Real Blend. And on this week's show, we got a lot of Kevin Smith coming your way. We're doing a Kevin Smith tier list on the show, which is going to be difficult because we have to pick his masterpiece. That's how we do it with directors. The Rings of Power is going to premiere this week, and we're also joined by the CEO of Marcus Theaters, who's going to be talking about a very cool initiative that's hitting on Saturday, September 3rd, kicking off the weekend. So we're going to get to that in a minute. And by we, I mean Kevin McCarthy, Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Sean, Jake, Gabriel. Good to see you guys this morning or afternoon or evening, whatever time anyone's listening to this.
That is also Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 and Chicago. Hi, Jake. How are you?
Mr. O'Connell, how are you, sir?
I'm well. I'm doing very well. And then Gabe Kovach is sitting in the chair. Is presiding over this lunacy, which you can watch on YouTube if you would like to. Head over to youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast.
And you should, because we're all very good looking.
I have to admit that I really do enjoy Friday mornings after the show's been out for like an hour or two, and I'll remember and I'll be like, oh shoot, let me go over and check. And then like we have some nice comments underneath, and any episode that kind of hits like 1,000, I know 1,000 is like a benchmark, but like we've established on this show that I like nice round numbers, and that stuff makes me really happy. So please go to the YouTube channel and watch it, and hit like and subscribe and follow us over that way.
Maybe refresh a few times.
Yeah. And let a friend know also what we're doing over here. And of course, we're available all the different places you can get audio podcast needs met. If you really like the show and you want more of the show, including an additional segment on Monday, and then this Monday, from what I understand, we're going to be playing something called the Box Office Game, which is my favorite game that we play. Check the description for information on how you can sign up for Real Blend Premium and getting fun things like a newsletter and, you know, the opportunity to send us questions through a mailbag and all that jazz. Basically, more Real Blend, more fun stuff from these guys. Kev was going to say something. No?
Oh, no, no. I was actually just watching you speak and thinking how good you are at your job.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that.
I'm being serious.
Like, you suck up.
No. I had the same. It was like deja vu. There was a moment. Well, I guess we'll tease this coming up. There was an interview we did recently where Sean and the guest had a special moment. I was watching. Oh, I was like, oh, wow. They're going back and forth there. That's good.
Yeah, we were vibing.
And then Kevin and I were sitting there like, well, this is fun. We'll just sit back till they're done.
Sometimes you got to get out of the way of greatness, guys. Just let it play itself out. I got to throw it to Gabe because
as a Hornets fan, you would understand that.
We are constantly getting out of the way of greatness. Gabe has an announcement, a sad announcement for everybody who listening to Real Blend.
It's a bittersweet announcement, but I think it's more sweet than bitter.
Bittersweet.
This is a good announcement.
Explain it.
And it references what Kevin was just discussing. So next week, Sean and I will be at TIFF. D23 is also happening. It's a busy week, and we will not be having our typical Friday full show that you all know and love. But instead, if you thought we'd leave you a week without content, we have over an hour that we spent last night, Tuesday night, with Kevin Smith talking about Clerks 3, no spoilers, talking about his film and his legacy in a way, and a lot of other really interesting things. It was a great discussion. And as Kevin mentioned, there is an awesome moment where Kevin Smith and Sean kind of geek out about some Bruce Willis stuff, which was really sweet. Yes. So I think that's more sweet than bitter, but it is bittersweet. No full show, but in its place, Friday morning will be our Kevin Smith interview.
Also, I want to tease that there's a really cool David Fincher connection to this
interview. Oh, such a great story. Oh, I don't want to give too much away.
If you're a Fincher fan, this is a great story.
Also, yeah. I want to tease too, and I won't, again, we're not going to tease the entire interview away. But if you guys will get to hear Kevin Smith's version of him driving us to Quentin Tarantino.
That's true. That's true.
We talked about it already, but he will now give you his take on it. And
how also, I want to tease. No, I'm just kidding.
Kevin's now an Uber driver.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Friend of the show. We have to. Kevin Smith, definitely friend of the show. Friend of the right? show.
I think we can say that.
He's a return guest. Yeah. I feel like all return guests are friends.
He had Real Blend over his house to watch Clerks 3.
Above and beyond. Yeah.
Well, he's friend of the show until we discuss his films in a tier list.
That's true.
And rank them.
Yeah, so I love his movies, so I'm good.
Yes, you do. And I love most of them as well, too. So let's get right into this. This is the Kevin Smith tier list.
On the internet, you may have seen a tier list. It's pretty straightforward. We're going to run through his filmography and rank them using a letter grade, A, B, C, D, and F. But this one has a twist from some of the other ones that we do with filmmakers, with directors specifically. We like to reserve the S tier, what we would typically hold as an S tier for franchises and such, as their masterpiece. And we go as far as giving us the rule that they can only have one masterpiece, and we have to agree on that masterpiece. So we're going to go through his filmography, and the way that this works is we're going to average our scores. So let's say two of us give one film an A and two of us give one film a C. That film will land in the B tier. And when the math gets more complicated than that, we'll do our best, but we're having fun.
And Gabe, we've never done it like this before, because like what I think is cool about this is, I mean, in the past, we've had multiple like S's.
Tarantino, we had the masterpiece tier.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we did that.
You're right. It was only our second one.
Did we end up on Hollywood? Did we do Hollywood for his?
No, we did Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. Yeah, so go back, check out some of our other tier list stuff. They're really fun. People at home tend to respond really well to these. And let us know what your tier list looks like.
Quentin was our first one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's cool. And then we're doing Kevin. I mean, we got to do Christopher Nolan, man.
Well, I'm hoping
can't do Nolan.
I'm gonna be sick that day, guys.
Would Spielberg have to be like a multi-part? I would actually need to go back and like watch a lot. I would need to like rewatch. Sure.
Wow,
like Always and
well, like, you know, people mentioned doing an A24 tier list, which I still think is a great idea. But Gabe and I looked over the list of A24 films, and there are a lot I haven't seen.
There've got to be like nearly 100 by this point,
at least.
They said they're going to do 24 films and then they're going to quit the business.
What was the 24th movie they released? That'd be
That's a great trivia question.
Well, let's start out with Kevin Smith. Let's get to it. And we have, we're going to start where it all started, which is Clerks.
That's got to be an A.
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 Interesting. I would give Clerks a B. I don't think he comes out the gate with his strongest material. It's a special film, not necessarily knowing.
We talk about the influence in the world, in pop culture, in the world of filmmaking. And I think when you look at, you know, Clerks was a part of that. You know, we talk about like that indie filmmaker boom with Tarantino and
for sure.
You know, I think that has to play a major part in it.
Yeah. And Clerks to me, like, I've said this before, but like growing up, like, on my walls in my house, and like it was Kevin Smith and Tarantino. So it was like these Mallrats was actually the first movie I found of his because of a band called Silverchair. They had a track on the Mallrats soundtrack, so I went and found that movie, and that brought me back to Clerks. And I know we'll get to Mallrats shortly, but Clerks, as I've watched it over the years, it's funny because I feel like Kevin has become such a great dramatic director over the years. I mean, even like the end of Clerks 2 with the jail scene. So like Clerks 1 is like, to me, it's so fun to watch because it's the beginning of that guy's career and the beginning of his of the Viewaskew universe. You know what I mean?
But so it's like, rough. It is rough.
But to me, the roughness is kind of this what makes it so special, because there are laughs in that film that there's a scene in that film where Randall is ordering pornography in front of a mom holding her kid. And it's one of my, that scene makes me laugh so hard. Like there are like moments in there. And then the whole dialogue about Star Wars and the Death Star and everything like that, it really kind of opened up. Like I think of Clerks when I watch Star Wars now, you know what I mean? Sometimes
it's one of the great hangout movies in terms of, like, you know, movies where you just kind of drop in and chill with the characters. Like, to me, it's the one, I would argue, one of the quintessential hangout movies.
So you and two also are like at an A.
Well, last thing I'll say is this, and we've all seen Clerks 3, and I don't think we're putting that.
We're not doing 3. Yeah.
But I will tell you this, Clerks 3 made me appreciate Clerks so much more. And for people who, I mean, this is not a spoiler, but in the trailers for Clerks 3, you know that Randall has a heart attack and they're making Clerks basically within Clerks 3. And they're reframing shots. And like Kevin talks about how they used HBO Max to do that. But as you watch Clerks 3, you realize like there's a very famous scene in the first Clerks where they're driving to that funeral, right? And Randall and Dante are in the car and the camera's like whipping back and forth between both of them in the front seat. And in Clerks 3, when they're playing around with scenes like that, you start to go, oh my God, it's crazy that to think that the DP was just in the back of the car with a 16mm black and white camera or whatever doing. I mean, it does, to me, Clerks 3 makes Clerks better. I've always loved it, so I'm in an A.
I would argue that it doesn't help the film itself, but I see what you're saying. I can't go higher than I'm gonna stay at B. So it's up to Gabe to break the tie.
I'm also gonna put it at an A. And again, maybe it's we're having fun, so you know, we don't take this all very too seriously. But I think
speak for yourself, sir.
Regardless of like, especially when you look at how much he grew as a filmmaker. Story, technical, all that stuff, and not even giving it the caveat of like, oh, it was completely indie and he, you know, paid for it out of his pocket or whatever. I just think it's such a special film for that era as one side of the indie filmmaking coin when that came out, that for me it hits that sort of A status as a film in general.
Okay, so this
is gonna be tough for me.
Not gonna argue that hard.
I love all of these.
Yeah.
All right.
And I would say, and also for new people, if I were to have said B and it was split, we round up for positivity's sake out of the love of movie. Would
be I like that
way.
I think we're going to have a problem on this one because so we're doing Mallrats. Yeah. This is
a reminder. I'm not guessing that this is your masterpiece, but a reminder.
No.
We'll come back around to get those. So just if that's what you're thinking, we'll put it at A for now.
So Mallrats is my favorite movie that he's made. And it's because, and I showed this to him yesterday, but I'll show it now because it's a different episode. But when I was a kid, like I told you, I found Silverchair and I found out what Mallrats was. So I remember there was an HBO or a Cinemax or a Showtime, whatever it was, free weekend. And I bought one of those like 6 hour, 8 hour tapes. And I just recorded a bunch of stuff. And I remember going to the TV guide and I was like, okay, so it was 7 from Dusk Till Dawn. And then I was like, oh, my God, I remember that Mallrats movie. That's the movie that has the Silverchair song on it. So I recorded it. Mallrats to this day, like Jason Lee's performance in that film is incredible. Like it is such a funny, like just I don't know. It's funny because Mallrats is such a 90s movie. But I also was a mall kid. So I went to the mall every Friday night with my buddy Dan. And his parents would drop us off in 7th, 8th, 9th grade. And so to spend an R-rated film in a mall and then, you know, having fun with these characters like Jay and Silent Bob, or the whole thing about getting the tape and like Silent Bob using the Force. And like there's just so many like phenomenal moments in that film. And then Ethan Suplee, is that how you pronounce his last name?
Suplee.
Who obviously is trying to see the sailboat. I mean, that is still one of the funniest scenes ever when that kid says, oh, it's a sailboat. He goes, you dumb bastard. And like, he's like, ha, 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 you dumb bastard. I think that's such a funny line. But yeah, I mean, Mallrats will always be special to me. I think Michael Rooker is hilarious in it. There's just a lot in that movie. And I've said this before, but Kevin, to me, has always been on the forefront of pop culture in before things really, really blew up in the movies. Like, to me, like, he always had comic book stuff in his movies. Stan Lee has the best cameo ever in Mallrats. And to me, that's why it's an A.
Jake, where do you put it?
It's a B for me. I like Mallrats, but there's a lot of stuff in there that doesn't work for me. I rewatched it about a year ago, and it was one of those things that for everything that landed, there was just something that just really fell flat. I give it the edge of like still like more works than doesn't, but enough doesn't work for me that I just can't put it in the A status.
And Jonathan?
I'm also a B. I'm chalking it up still to a filmmaker who's figuring out what he's doing. I think Jake hits the nail on the head that there's stuff in it that works really well for me. Kevin, I'm with you that Jason Lee is my favorite Kevin Smith actor. Mm-hmm. I love Jason Lee's humor. I love Jason Lee when he goes on to do other things.
He's
I love
so
him
good.
In Almost Famous. I love
Almost
him
Famous.
My
yes.
Name is Earl. I just think he's extremely funny. And when he came back for, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, I was thrilled. It was so happy to see him back in that universe because I think he's retired. I love everything about him in that movie. But, you know, there's a bunch of clunky shit in Mallrats that is excusable. You know, it's still a filmmaker figuring it out. But I want to try and save A for a legitimate, you know, noteworthy films, and I think calling Mallrats a B is perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, and it's also like, you know, again, I'm coming at this from a very personal perspective, right?
Absolutely.
Like,
you
know, like that I mean I'm not saying you guys aren't, but like that movie was my intro to him.
Sure.
And it was
sure.
like and it was the one I watched. I mean, I probably watched this tape on a loop.
Yeah.
And by the way, then this little tease, this is the reason why Fincher came up yesterday when we talked to him, and that turns into a cool, funny
we'll get
story
into that.
As well.
We'll get into that. So, I am also now a lot of these, especially his early stuff. A lot of these I have not really seen in a long time, so I do feel there's a little bit of fogginess to some of these. I also have this as a B, but it's been long enough that I wonder how much I've changed and if it would be an A or different.
Anybody know what that poster is referencing?
I'm assuming it's a comic book. I just don't know. It's funny. Like, I don't know. You're more of a comic book reader than I am. But which one is it? I'm assuming it's something.
No, I think it's a riff on National Lampoon's Vacation.
Oh, do you?
Oh, it's interesting. I thought it was Army of the Dead because the girl clings to Bruce Campbell's leg in Army of the Dead when he's like standing above everybody.
Wait, Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
Might also be possible too. I always picture Chevy Chase and then Beverly D'Angelo clinging to his legs.
The style of, oh yeah, that's true too.
Dude,
but who leg clung first? Was it Army of Darkness or Vacation probably?
Dude, when Jay and Silent Bob beat up the Easter Bunny, it's that movie is amazing, man.
We'll keep it moving with the next film in his filmography, Chasing Amy.
Okay, so Amy's an A to me.
Amy's an A.
And
it
Amy
is an A.
To me is his strongest movie, not Kevin Smith movie, but movie across the board. I think it has his strongest writing, and his strongest characterization. I think Ben Affleck and Jason Lee and Joey Lauren Adam all give really strong performances. I think there's enough of a mix of Kevin Smith humor, and I think in Chasing Amy was the first time, because Kevin brings a lot of heart to his comedies. I think that starts with Chasing Amy, and he just continues to develop it over the course of his films from there on out.
Right.
It's also, as you know, a very personal story for him.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of that shines through in it. And if he only made Chasing Amy from that point out, if his career was legitimately Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, I think we'd still be talking about him. I think we'd still be saying those three movies, you know, from a filmmaker right out the gate was incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
And again, Jason Lee in this movie is terrific. I love him in this.
Yeah. And Amy also has probably my favorite Silent Bob monologue because,
yes,
like, you know, one of the best things about the Kevin Smith movies is like when Silent Bob breaks and finally speaks, and like, you know, it happens you know, randomly in his movies, which is, I guess that's like his Hitchcock thing, right? Like yep. His, that moment is like the thing you're waiting for. What's the moment that's going to break Silent Bob open? And that one in particular is like my favorite. It's just the, cause you know, as you said, Sean, it's a personal movie for him. Everybody in that film, I mean, like Affleck, obviously, like, and Affleck's, you know, such an a-hole in Mallrats, but it's a great character. The character's an a-hole, but he's great as that character. But in terms of Amy, it's like you really start to see that drama come out. And that's why I think as you get through his filmography and like Clerks 2 and even with Clerks 3, you start to see things that were maybe building in Amy. But yeah, this is a hard tier list for me because he's probably top three filmmakers for me of all time, like personally on a personal level. So
is this an A for you as well?
Yeah, I love it. And I probably sound biased and people are probably gonna be like, oh, Kevin, well, you know, Kevin from the Affleck thing. And no, if we were doing this list 5 years ago and I didn't know Kevin Smith,
There's going to be there's going to be a few coming up that you give A's to.
But I want to make sure people know, like, this is just, you know, I love that. I love his films and I give that an A.
And in general, I would say if people are concerned about anyone's bias, who cares? We're making a tier list about movies on a podcast.
No, I know, but I do have a very strange connection to Kevin Smith. Course, so I wanted to make sure that I put that out there.
Yeah. I think that's totally fair disclaimer. And Jake.
Yeah, I would give an A, B, an A. I think it's his strongest script as a writer. I think there's a really solid argument to be made that he should have gotten an Oscar nomination. I read his book a couple of years ago. And again, this was before I think I was really following, you know, the world of Academy Award nominations and buzz and stuff like that. But from my understanding, there was like real talk about him getting an Oscar nomination for Amy, which I think would have been very well deserved. Yeah, for Best Original Screenplay. I think it's his best work. My understanding is the studio actually really went to bat, like really like for like some heavy for your consideration advertising dollars. But yeah, I think that's his strongest work as a writer. So I think that's a solid A.
So great.
Heck yeah.
And Jason Lee and Affleck are so great together. So great together.
I didn't know he took, or I had forgotten this. I didn't know he took Clerks to Cannes. I didn't know it was a Cannes film.
Mm-hmm. The first one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, I think the Sundance was Sundance was like, what, that January, right? And then he took it to Cannes. Yeah, 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 that's right. Because that's cool. because didn't Pulp Fiction win the Palme d'Or that year?
Yeah. Yeah, and he won Award of the Youth for Foreign Film and the Mercedes-Benz Award. Hey. Which hopefully he got a Benz out of that. We'll have to ask Kevin next time. That's a big deal, man. They just give you a Mercedes if you win that award or what?
Well, you're on your own to get it back. It's just sitting on the beach. Yeah, it's like it's yours, but you can do it. You have to figure it out how to get it back.
Dogma, which was a great discussion on the podcast that folks will get to hear next week. Who wants to take Jake? We haven't heard from you out of the gate. Dogma, where are you at?
I hate to keep doing this because we'll mix it up very shortly. But I'm going to give Dogma an A. I think Dogma is a really nice eclectic blend of so many things that that Kevin does well. And Kevin often describes what he does is taking toys off of a shelf and kind of playing with them. And what he does with this like incredible ensemble of actors between Matt and Ben, Chris Rock, what he does with Alan Rickman. I mean, the late, great Alan Rickman reading Kevin Smith dialogue. It's just something that I don't think we truly appreciate enough. Salma Hayek. I mean, like there are so many things about this. And then we talked about Chasing Amy being personal. Dogma is incredibly personal. Like Kevin Smith has been very open about his complicated relationship with Catholicism. And I just think that so much about Dogma is Kevin Smith at his most Kevin Smith, but doing it at a top tier level. So I hate to throw another A up there, but for me, Dogma's an A.
It's also like a super like he started kind of putting violence in his movies with that film. Remember how that movie gets pretty.
You didn't say God bless you when I sneezed.
Right. And I think I'm trying to remember before that, like it's aside from like joking violence, we hadn't seen him play with like some hardcore stuff like that. Right. Like Dogma. Dogma's a pretty hardcore film. Like like I'm talking like not just like come to a content wise, like the R rating. I remember you guys remember when we were kids. when they would like put an R rating out and you would like read what it's rated R for.
Sure.
And I remember that one was like 4 or 5 lines. Yeah. And it was like strong sexual content, whatever it was. But I remember seeing Dogma at Regal and Kiln Creek in Newport News, Virginia. And again, this was like right off the heels of like, you know, I'd already fallen in love with Mallrats and Clerks and Chasing Amy. And I mean, it's funny if you actually timestamp this for a second and think about where you were at this point. So, you know, this guy has released Clerks, Chasing Amy, Mallrats, and now Dogma. You know, all four of those films are very different. I mean, they play within a world that is obviously similar, but they're all, in my opinion, very tonally different. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe Clerks and Mallrats you could probably put into a similar boat. But Dogma was a stretch, and it was a unique experience. And again, you just forget how many films Affleck did with him. Like, I mean, like you just like all the work they did together. It's amazing. And Damon and Affleck are so great in this. Alanis Morissette's fantastic in it. Jay and Silent Bob, of course, they're great characters within the world as well. I mean, I'm going to go A as well. I think Dogma it's a really, really, but Dogma is also, it's a really hardcore film. And I say that not lightly because it's not a movie that is easy to watch. Like it's kind of it's pretty heavy. Sure. But also comedic. And he kind of weighs that and balances it really well. But God, man, yeah, Alan Rickman, man, what a performance from him in that. That's not fair. He's so great. And I need to rewatch that. I have the DVD.
Sean, does this reach the A tier for you?
It does.
Beautiful.
And I think this is the last great movie that Kevin has made.
I disagree with that.
Because I think it's the most original idea and the most complicated idea that he's had, which is these angels that have been banished from heaven and they figure out a loophole on how they could potentially get back in. And the conversations that Matt and Ben have through the course of Dogma are really, really fascinating from a Catholic point of view about why should they be banished if they were essentially doing the Lord's work. But in between that, Kevin also brings this really interesting and in ways that I had not seen in other films at all, let alone mainstream comedies, these criticisms leveled at Catholicism, where I'll always remember this one panning shot there's a priest giving a sermon and they pan the audience and one person's asleep. One person's balancing their checkbook. Like, and I've seen this. I've watched this happen in church where like everyone's zoning out, you know, and so when Ben and Matt have these conversations about like, we're far more invested in this than all these other people who he's supposedly, you know, saving and invested in, they're big ideas. They're mm-hmm. huge ideas coming from this director who does dick and fart jokes, you know,
which there are plenty in Dogma.
but Jake, a lot of feces in that movie too. Remember, isn't there a poop monster?
There's a huge poop monster. I'm still giving this an A, even though there's a giant poop monster.
But it's the same reason why in Clerks 2, which we'll get to, where you go from a donkey scene to a jail scene where you could be crying.
I hate the donkey scene.
The point I'm making is that he is able to have a shit monster. And then also stick the landing. Like he just finds that tone. I don't know. It's not easy.
But this was interesting too. When Dogma came out, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck were still doing the Good Will Hunting, you know, the Talented Mr. Ripley's.
Yeah.
Affleck might have been trying to go more into the action role.
That was around Armageddon.
But people were still surprised to see 97? Their level of caliber. In a Kevin Smith movie, and it showed how dedicated they were to Kevin still at that point, right? But for them to still be doing crude humor was was interesting. It was really interesting to see them doing it. And Jake mentioned all the other people who are in it. George Carlin's terrific. Alan Rickman, like you mentioned, it's also the first time that Kevin Smith started to figure out how larger than life Jay and Silent Bob are. Like when they show up, they descend from the sky and save who's that actress? Linda Fiorentine, is that her name?
I don't remember.
Take a look. They save her from the hockey kids.
Yeah, I love that scene.
Linda Linda Fiorentino.
Fiorentino.
The Hagen kids are such terrible people. They're just like evil.
And it's like, but like Jay and Silent Bob like descend down because it didn't they find out like that town was from a John Hughes movie?
I'm trying to remember. It's been years since I've seen Dog. I need to go back
and
watch
Jay,
it.
Jay like mocks Silent Bob for wanting to come and see the town where like where John Hughes filmed so-and-so. So anyway, I think it's one of his better uses of Jay and Silent Bob. And that's why when we get to the next one, I will discuss that I was disappointed because I thought coming after these four movies.
Well, before
I was really encouraged to see the next Kevin Smith movie.
This is going
to
be a problem.
Before you get there.
Yeah.
Well, what's a perfect tease because we're going to take a
support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Quick break.
Oh, good idea.
And on the other side, we just closed out the 90s. And we'll pick back up.
We're done with the 90s.
The rest Apple of Kevin sauce. Smith's filmography right after this break. And we are back. And we're picking things back up with Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. A lot of backs in that sense. Didn't mean to do it, but it rolled.
Sean, we're going to have an issue on this one.
Sean, do you want to kick us off where we left it?
Sure.
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Because I remember going to see this movie in theaters opening weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so excited because I loved Chasing Amy. And I was really impressed by Dogma. And I have come to like Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back more over the years. But the first time that I watched it, I really hated it.
What?
Because I thought it was really stupid.
Who are you?
I thought, well, I'm telling you the truth.
I thought it?
I thought that Kevin in Chasing Amy and in Dogma had a nice balance of story and amateurish jokes, like childish jokes. And I thought Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back from start to finish was just Kevin's
awesome.
Id humor, you know, unfiltered, essentially. And I think that there are still some really, really funny bits in it. But then there are also some insufferable things to sit through. So I would have been at a...
Don't do it.
I would have been at a D my first time through.
God, man.
But now I'm probably at a B. Because sometimes the comedy sometimes just doesn't work for me, but I have grown to appreciate the humor in it a lot more. Yeah, and I do think it's infinitely quotable. But there are
You opened the show with a quote from that movie.
No, I did. And there's some very funny scenes in it. But you know what it is? It's too much Jay. It's just
never too much Jay.
There is in this movie. In this movie.
Okay,
so well, Sean puts it as at a B, which
I'm gonna
I think
put
is
it at a B.
Perfectly
yes.
fine.
Yes.
Kevin, right, are you a B or are you an A?
Well, of course I'm an A, but let me tell you why. First of all, from the opening scene and the opening moment and the two little kids growing up to Jay and Silent Bob, that movie, I was in love with that film, let alone the scenes that take place later on in that film. But the Good Will Hunting 2 hunting season scene is my favorite scene he's
always
ever written.
Of course.
I still can't believe Affleck and Damon did that. I know that they're in his movies, but like to come back and do a bit about Good Will Hunting, which was a relatively serious film, and have Gus Van Sant on the set joking about money. is just incredibly hilarious.
You're skipping over a lot of movie.
Well, all right. Well, then I'll go back. I'll keep it quick though. But like from the beginning point forward.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say I don't want to walk through the whole movie. I'll keep it quick. But I understand what you're saying. Yes.
So I love the idea of Jay and Silent Bob being so ignorant towards like the movie business that they're just living their lives, that they don't know that a movie's being made about them, that they actually are owed money. It's a great concept. They go to L.A., you know, Hollywood to try and stop the movie, you know, Bluntman and Chronic, and the scenes with Jason Lee, the scenes with Ben Affleck. You know, there are lines in that movie that I think are the best lines he's ever written. And I also love the love story between Jay and Shannon Elizabeth. I dig that storyline. On top of that, maybe the only thing I don't maybe necessarily.
The rest of the girls in that crew are terrible.
No, they're not terrible. I don't know that maybe like, I don't know. I mean, cause to me, like I thought Jen was great. His wife was great in it. I thought that Eliza Dushku was great. I mean, maybe those scenes weren't as like well-written in my opinion.
They're very liberal with the word great.
They are devouring scenery.
I love that movie. So I'm in an A, but I want to say this. So you guys have to remember, like Kevin is a huge Star Wars fan. There is a scene in that film where he has a lightsaber fight with Mark Hamill, who's playing Sea Knocker. I mean, I'm telling you, and Chris Rock.
But is that good?
Oh my God, it's hilarious! And then Jay takes the hit off the bong of the lightsaber, the bong saber, and then Chris Rock's hilarious in it. Will Ferrell's hilarious in it.
Will Ferrell's not hilarious.
Will
Ferrell is not funny in it.
And I want to say, you know, this is important to note, and this is probably something that we don't have to say every time, but like, you know, all these movies came out, you know, in the 90s and early 2000s. So there's jokes in these films that probably don't hold up today or are not appropriate today. But we're just talking about these from our experiences.
I just thought of the acronym for the, the group that steals the diamonds.
But dude, I'm telling you right now, and I'll end on this. That film. So I remember getting the soundtrack to that movie and I spent
great soundtrack
months riding around in my car listening to that. And then I would just like, you know, when you watch Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs for the first time, hold on. When you watch Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs for the first time and you hear a song and then every time you hear that song afterwards, you immediately think of the film that you saw it in.
Sure.
Like that's what Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was for me. There are like songs in that soundtrack that will forever be that movie. Also, George Carlin's funny. You forgot that Carrie Fisher's in it. She's hilarious.
So when hear Bad Medicine by Bon Jovi, you think of a giant big gulp cup.
I do.
Stuck to Jason Mewes.
Jake, round us off for this because we need to keep rolling. Jake, where do you put it?
It's a B. Jay and Silent Bob should not be lead characters. I think they're great secondary characters, but they should not be the focus of a movie.
Bazinga.
Have you seen Jay and Silent Bob Reboot? I thought you guys liked that film.
Well, we'll get there. The Kevin Smith dick and fart humor is my least favorite aspect of Kevin Smith, but I think it works. If there ends up being like, if it's part of like a setup 1-2 punch, like you mentioned with Clerks 2, the donkey scene leading into the jail scene, I'm much more forgiving of that humor whenever it's like, whenever it is followed by like this real, like meaningful, like something. So much of Clerks 3, like the first act is the iconic sort of Kevin Smith humor and then leading into some very real stuff of substance. There is no stuff of substance in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. It's nothing but that type of humor. And again, like I was 12 when it came out, and yeah, there's a lot, like there are a lot of things that I thought were really funny then, but like there's nothing of substance in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back like there is in Dogma Chasing Amy, or like there is in his best stuff. It's nothing but a movie full of the stuff that's my least favorite aspect of him as a filmmaker.
That movie is making commentary on things that are happening today on the internet. Think about that for a second.
Yeah, but just because it's saying something doesn't mean it's saying something well.
No, I'm saying that movie's ahead of its time in that sense. I think that Kevin has always been
20 years later, if it were that ahead of its time, it's time now. It would be there.
Yeah, I'm just talking about in terms of like the things he was commenting on, like the internet and the fictional characters and people blasting people online.
A B is solid, which is why it earned a B.
That will, that puts it at a B, and we'll keep it moving. But I can't
believe Mallrats and Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back are in the B category. This is
B is a good category.
Kevin, you would put them all at A.
Not all of them, but those two I would.
But you did for sure. But my favorite quote from this part of our segment was Sean saying it's full of ridiculous child humor. and I've grown to enjoy it more over the years. that's my favorite quote. Jersey
Girl. Can I tell a very quick story? I know we're running
very
out of
quick,
time.
Very quick.
A very quick story.
We got a lot of movies. Yeah.
Kevin was going to have a screening of Red State. In his home for critics.
I remember this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said, I forget how he was going to do it. And he was looking for ways for people to enter. And I wrote a tweet that I'm still so proud of to this day, where I said, guys, I watched the end of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. He's just luring us to his house so he can kick our asses. And I got a direct message from Kevin, and it said, that was hilarious. You're in.
Yes. Oh,
awesome. Dude, I got in on that too. Why did it never happen?
I just couldn't get there. I couldn't get myself there. He basically
It didn't happen. I don't think so. I remember that tweet. I remember like people like tweeting to get to his house.
Yeah.
And like that would seem like such an insane thing to be able to go to Kevin Smith's house and watch Red State.
I stopped paying attention when I realized I wasn't going to be able to get there. But
Jersey Girl. Who wants to kick off the Jersey Girl discussion? Jake, how do you feel about Jersey Girl?
It's a perfectly fine C for me. It's hard to knock it because there's not a lot wrong with it. It's sweet and it's very charming. But I would put it in that category of like it doesn't really feel like a Kevin Smith movie. There's not a lot of Kevin Smith injected in there. You got to give him props for like trying something new, but the stuff that I expect out of a Kevin, the reason I press play on a Kevin Smith movie, is almost entirely absent from there. So for me, it's a perfectly fine, nothing wrong, nothing special C film.
I think it's a B.
B? Would you say this is his most has his most cable time? Because I feel like I've seen scenes from this more than any of his films just because it's like TV growing up.
Isn't this his first PG-13 movie?
Probably. Let me look and see.
That's probably why.
Looking at the others, if we're going in chronological order, there's no way the others are PG-13.
It's PG-13 and it's a big cast. Like, it makes sense.
I always think of it
as one that I think I've seen the most just of like, because it had that cable appeal where it was just on.
I rewatched Jersey Girl a couple years ago, and I thought it was better than I remembered.
You have it at a B?
I have it at a B. I actually think it's a solid film. It's not, and again, I definitely prefer his more R-rated material because I think it kind of flows well. But
it's so interesting because he rips this movie so much.
I like Jersey Girl,
and I don't think that he needs to.
No.
I'm with Kevin that I think it's a soft, soft, soft B. Yeah. Because what Jake says is that there's nothing wrong with it. But there's no reason that I would necessarily be like, oh, you got to go out and see it. But I think that it gets knocked by Kevin and then by the industry a lot more than it should because.
But also
landed,
remember what happened. Oh, I'm sorry. I interrupted.
It landed right at that time when Affleck and Jennifer Lopez were going through their relationship.
It came out in the wake of Geely. So
yes.
Like Geely had come out like 4 months before. And then another movie with even though she's hardly in it, another movie with them. So like the critics were sharpening their knives.
No, I want to go back and revisit this because isn't Will Smith, doesn't he cameo in this movie later? He's the star, I think, that Affleck is trying to manage. Essentially.
Don't they sit down and have like a heart to heart?
And it has something to do with kids, like raising kids, I want to say. Yeah. It's been too long, I want to go back and revisit that.
You guys call it Geely? I call it Giggly.
No, Geely.
No, Geely is definitely joking. let's keep it moving. We've got plenty of these to go through, and we have more show after this. Clerks 2. We're going to quickly go around the horn, Clerks 2. Sean, where do you put Clerks 2?
Clerks 2 is a C.
Oh, my God.
Jake, where do you put Clerks 2?
Oh, my God.
It's a B for me in that almost kind of like the Mallrats thing. There's a lot of stuff that works for me, but then there's a lot of stuff that just really doesn't. The stuff that works beautifully, and the stuff that doesn't, I just kind of throw my hands up in the air and just kind of choose to ignore it.
Kev, is this another A for you?
I'm going A, and let me take two minutes.
Yeah, go ahead.
I got to point out the scenes why I'm giving this an A. One, the King Diamond sequence is hilarious. Two, the jail scene's one of my favorite scenes he's ever written. First time I ever cried in a Kevin Smith movie. Three, you know, the Lord of the Rings versus Star Wars monologue from Randall. There is just like there are moments in Clerks 2, and I know that you guys are considering like the whole, and I love Clerks 2, the Rosario Dawson Jackson 5 ABC dance sequence. Like this movie is I was so I remember in 2006 I remember seeing it because I was like, why would you make a Clerks 2? And then right. I just there's a shot at the end of that film when we're panning where we're, you know, we're coming back and he goes into black and white from color, which gives me chills just to think about it. And again, one of the things that's really hard about doing a tier list with his movies is like, you know, when you're watching Kevin Smith movies since you're a kid and they're all interconnected in this Viewskew universe,
right?
You just love, I love spending time with these people. I love spending time with Dante and Randall. You know, I loved Rosario Dawson in that film. I thought Jane Silent Bob were great. Affleck has a really funny cameo or a brief cameo. But like, I don't know. To me, I loved Clerks 2 when it came out, and that, I still love it today.
That averages us to a B on Clerks 2. We'll do quickly Zach and Miri Make a Porno. Kev, where does Zach and Miri Make a Porno for you?
I like that film. It's a unique
one in his filmography.
Yeah, I mean, Seth Rogen and Elizabeth Banks are, you know, they're great in it. It's definitely different. It's a different vibe for him. I'm going to go B on that.
B, Jake, where you got?
It's a C for me. It just really, I don't know how to describe my feelings toward this movie other than to say it just feels like Kevin's heart is not in it. It feels like.
Does it feel more?
It just doesn't feel like one, like
it's like weird. It's weird to say, almost got in there.
We're going to talk more about it, I think, based on the next film. But it just feels like a movie that he's not directing for himself. And this is a filmmaker.
Is it one of his scripts, or did he do someone else's script?
Cop Out's not his script.
Zach and Miri is.
Yeah. It just doesn't feel like him.
Jake's making a good point. There's like, it's almost that there's something off about it. Like,
is it because it's not Viewskew? Like, it's not kind of set in that world?
Maybe.
I think, yeah, because it was also strange seeing Jay play a different character. And even Jeff Anderson plays a different character. And those aren't bad things, but it is like I think what Jake's getting at, and I could be wrong, I won't put words in Jake's mouth, but like when I was watching Multiverse of Madness, I felt like a pull between the filmmaker and the studio and the MCU in general. I saw Raimi diving in there and doing what he does best. And then you could, like, at least for me, I could feel Kevin Feige or the MCU kind of going, oh no, come back this way kind of thing. And I think in Zach and Miri, you almost get that feeling. Like, you feel Kevin Smith's vibe, like when they're filming like the porno sequences or like someone's pouring coffee beans. Like those are really funny moments. But then you do almost feel like it does play out a little more structured, like a studio film. I thought so.
I would put Jersey Girl, Zach and Miri, and then Cop Out in a trilogy of movies where I almost go, oh, that's right, those are Kevin Smith movies.
Yeah, but Cop Out's just bad.
All right, Jake has it at a C. Kevin has it at a B. Sean, did you give your grade?
I watched it once and I don't remember a single thing about it. So I don't know if that's fair for me to rank. But does that make it a C? Makes it a C.
C sounds right.
If you feel like it's a haven't seen for you, then I think we'll put it at a C because that sounds right for me. C.
Okay.
I think we can quickly do Cop Out because you guys were kind of already talking about it. Cop Out.
It's an F.
F?
Yeah, Cop Out's bad. An F. Well, it's bad
F,
because
F across the board.
Hey, He didn't write it.
It's not funny.
No, it's bad. It's really not bad.
Funny. It's not well put together.
Jake, do you have it in F as well?
I would have probably said D. I get a D, but F, honestly, one or the other is not going to bother me. While I say Jersey Girl, Zach and Miri and Cop Out complete this, like, oh, that's weird. I forgot that's Zach, or I forgot that that's Kevin Smith trilogy. Cop Out just almost shouldn't be mentioned in Kevin Smith. It's just not a Kevin Smith movie.
Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan play partners. Like, they've been on the force for 20 years together, and their chemistry suggests that they met the day that they started film.
Right.
Which is probably true.
Also, it does. It's such a strange thing because Kevin always writes his movies. And like, I don't know the history there about like what happened or why he was brought on board. I mean, I'm assuming he was probably he worked with Bruce Willis.
Well, he said he took this gig to prove to himself and to his fans at the time that he could direct a studio picture.
Right. And
wasn't it supposed to be called A Couple of Dicks?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That wouldn't help.
That movie, it's kind of painful. Like it kind of like it hurt me as a fan when I saw it. I was like, ugh.
Yeah. I want to quickly go through these four so we can spend a little bit of time on the masterpiece discussion. Red okay. State, letter grade.
I think
Kevin.
I think I'm going to go with a B on that.
B? I'd go B.
Jake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really strong B plus, I guess. Like, yeah, yeah. It's got a lot to say.
Michael Parks. I want to shout out him out. And then also John Goodman. Was it the hound dog monologue at the end? Oh,
sure. Yeah.
And Tusk. Sean, where are you at Tusk?
Tusk's a C.
Go ahead, finish.
Tusk is a C. Yeah. I admire it for being completely bizarre, but like in terms of its quality, it's still a C.
You excited for Tusks?
Of course.
Yeah. Kev, where is Tusk for you?
I'm like, it's interesting because I really dug Red State. I kind of like this phase of Kevin's career, like where he tried these different genres. I also think the Tusk story about how it came about is cool. The movie, yeah, I'm probably more on the B minus side of it.
B.
Okay. I guess I'm gonna go B, but like I also don't under, I don't not I don't not trust the C aspect of it too. But I'm probably more B.
Jake.
I'd give it a very strong B. I equate it to, and by no means am I saying it's as good as, but I equate it to like From Dusk Till Dawn, where I think it's at its best before it gets into what it's actually about. Like Justin Long at Park's house, just sitting across that table having those conversations, I think is some of Kevin Smith's strongest work as a writer. And really great. And Michael Parks, like in those scenes, is no joke, I'm not blowing smoke, genuinely Oscar worth, like just phenomenal. Once it turns into what the point of the film is, I lose a lot of interest in the same way that once the vampires show up and from Dusk Till Dawn, I kind of check out. But it's enough for me to still say that I really dig Tusk.
All right. That puts us at a B, right? Did I calculate that all correctly?
Yeah,
that's fair.
Yoga hosers. Jake.
That's an honest F for me. I think it's just a nearly borderline unwatchable film.
I still haven't seen it, so I don't have a
like. I think everything about it is just unspeakably bad.
I'm not going to argue with Jake. The only reason I'd put it at D is because I think Cop Out is actually worse.
Yeah, it's true.
But we can't do that. That's part of the rules.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
both horrible.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with either D or F. I don't really care.
Yeah, we'll stick with the F. I mean, F? I don't like giving an F, but I mean, I do think Cop Out's worse than that. But
it hurts because Yoga Hosers is definitely his deal,
right? Know? And like, that hurts. Yeah. I think it's
a more personal F.
I'm gonna I'm gonna say D just for the record, but I don't have an issue with it being where it is.
That's two F's though. Were you both?
I'll say F.
F. Okay.
It's interesting to like do this and look at his stuff in chronological order and realize like sort of the trends that he went through as a director, like his very indie beginnings. Yeah. I feel like the Red State and Tusk era was a very like, fuck you, I'm going to show you what else I can do. Well, the Jersey Girl Cop Out, Zach and Miri was like almost him trying to be a little bit more commercial. And now I feel like he's in a much more reflective era.
He definitely made some reactionary decisions to the type of press he was getting like, I think Red State and Tusk and Zach and Miri, like you mentioned, were almost in response to
let me show you what I can do.
The hatred that he got for Jersey Girl, which wasn't fair. And so he kind of branched out and found the things that made him entertained.
Let's round off his list with Jane Silent Bob Reboot.
Reboot's an A.
Reboot's an A. Kev's an A. Reboot's an A. Jake, an A.
It's a really strong B for me. I really like, I think there's a lot of aspects in it that are some of his strongest work. It, again, for me, it falls into, the reason I give it a B is because it falls into the sort of hitch that I get held up on, which is I don't think that Jay and Silent Bob are strong enough to be lead characters. So I hesitantly give it a B.
I'm going to jump in and say, we reviewed this on the show, so go find our review of this if you want to hear more thoughts, but I want to hear your guys' thoughts on the masterpiece while we have time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go around to the three of you within the A category. I'll get all of them. We're going to get them all together and then we can have a discussion. So Jake, what are you going to nominate as a singular masterpiece from the A tier?
I'm going to say Dogma because I think it most represents what a Kevin Smith film is at the highest quality that that representation was put on film.
Kevin, what do you nominate?
I have to go with Clerks. Just for the same reason I'd go with Pulp Fiction. Right. They're you know, it's interesting, it's like
the seminal nature of them kind of thing.
Yeah, but even Tarantino doesn't, you know, again, I don't want to take him out of context, but he even looks at Pulp Fiction and has negative thoughts about it. But I think when I'm looking at Kevin Smith's career and like especially now that we're in 2022 and there's a Clerks 3 coming out, the longevity of that film, the longevity. I mean, Dante and Randall, I would just watch them sit around talking about anything. And I think it's interesting because I don't think Clerks is the best movie he's ever made. I think the word masterpiece here, in my opinion, would be his quintessential film that kind of just
right.
I think Clerks encompasses everything that Kevin Smith is. It's, you know, while he was a younger filmmaker, it's still his humor. It's the characters. It's well written. And it's funny because like even part of the charm of Clerks is the acting isn't even that great. Like, you know what I mean? Like Brian and Jeff aren't that great yet as actors. But like to me, that's part of the charm. I'm going Clerks.
We got Dogma. Sean, are you going to make this difficult? Are you going to make this easy?
Yeah.
Gonna make this very difficult.
He's going to Amy.
I mean, going into this exercise, I'd have thought Amy was my pick, but it's not of those four. And then I almost want to say Reboot because Reboot to me feels like the best representation of Kevin's full body of work.
Yeah.
But having discussed all of these movies, I think the best movie he has made is Dogma. I really do think it's Dogma. I think that it's
Kevin. Would you be upset if Dogma was
no?
Because it's great. I think we all
not at all.
Love no. Let me just briefly say why.
Go ahead.
I think it uses all of his day players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good choice. Great
in
choice.
In ways
actually.
that uses them to the best of their abilities. I think it's the best stuff that he gets out of both Matt and Ben. I think it's the best use of Jay and Silent Bob.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's him having the confidence to really dig into something that's really fascinating to him with it, which is Catholicism. And in terms of some of the things that ding for me, the Clerks movies, and even Jay and Silent Bob, and you guys describe them as hangout movies. I don't love a hangout movie as much as maybe you guys do. I kind of want a story. And I think Dogma has the best story that he's told. It's a legitimately compelling story. There are stakes. There's a reason that they have to get to this church, and there are multiple storylines that are converging on it, and I think it's great. I love all the commentary that he makes about with the worshiping of false idols through Mubi. I think it's the best movie he's ever
made. Dogma it is. There we have it, folks. Kevin Smith tier list.
That's Dogma, it. His masterpiece. I'm very content with.
I feel great about this list.
Wow. It's a good looking list.
That's great.
Yeah, and I don't know that Kevin Smith himself would. Well, Yoga Hosers, I don't know how he feels about Yoga Hosers. He might love that movie.
Oh no, he makes fun of it all the time.
Does he really? Interesting.
But I think he might this list.
Yeah. I mean, his daughter's in it, so I don't know if it's like a personal thing. You know what I mean?
Movies are always personal, I'm sure. Yeah. But this is the list averaged out across our opinions for Kevin Smith, and a reminder that next week he will be joining us on the show.
Wow.
Talk about some of his filmography and
return guest
and Clerks 3. But at the moment, I will. Throw it over to Sean, who is going to let the kids at home know what we have coming up next.
Well, that was weird seeing you guys come back up that screen like that. Oh my God. I was looking at like the, oh my God, my eyes.
Well, our next segment is brought to you by our partners at the National Association of Theater Owners. They've been nice enough to sponsor the show, and they gave us time with Rolando Rodriguez, who is the chairman and president and CEO. He's the chairman of NATO, and he's the president and CEO of Marcus Theaters, which is a largely Midwestern-based theater chain. And he wanted to come on to talk about some of the initiatives that they had all summer, and also this National Cinema Day that's coming up on Saturday, September 3rd. So here's our interview with Rolando Rodriguez of Marcus Theaters. How has this summer been for Marcus Theaters now that some of the blockbusters are back in full swing?
Look, it's been good. It's good to see the journey back, not just for Marcus Theaters, which we're very proud of that, but obviously for the overall industry to start seeing that momentum coming back, and in particular, seeing the consumer confidence, right? And the consumer confidence building as more and more films have been introduced into the marketplace, which was really the key challenge that we were facing as an industry over the course of the past, in particular, year and a half.
Rolando, there's a title that has been historic this summer, and that's Top Gun Maverick. And I'd love to get your reaction to just how that movie has performed, and what do you think it means for audiences coming back?
Well, first of all, you're asking the right person the right question, because I can tell you that Top Gun, the first one, was my all-time favorite movie. Call it craziness, and it's not because it's become such an incredible blockbuster and bringing back the industry this year, but it's actually one of my favorite. It's my all-time favorite film. So watching this second one, I remember talking to my friends at Paramount and saying, guys, you know, this is a tall order on Top Gun 2 to right. kind of, you know, beat Top Gun 1. And they did it. And I think it really speaks to that with Top Gun 2, and in particular, congratulate Tom Cruise and the team on what they did, is they were able to blend the nostalgic nature of the first one with obviously blending it in with the future Top Gun and the new characters that were introduced. Now, what it's meant to the industry, oh my God. I mean, I think that if you would have bet me, and I was, by the way, as I told you, my favorite all-time movie, and somebody would have said, Rolando, this movie is probably going to cross $700 million domestically, I might have lost a big bet, you know, just not because I didn't think the movie was going to do well, but it's done great. And for what it's meant for the industry, it's pumped an incredible amount of energy across all genres, you know, and in particular, just seeing women coming back to the film, you know, older women, older males, young males and young females, which are a big concern of whether this movie would capture that. And so here, this film has really garnered all demographics to really bring them back to the theater. And they watched a great film, which energized them into watching more and more of the films that were coming out this summer.
Yeah. So you learned essentially don't bet against Tom Cruise at the box office.
You know, and if you're Tom Cruise, you have to say, not, you know, I just said that it's probably going to cost $700 million. I think the chances are pretty strong here domestically, but it's already done $1.4 billion worldwide. And so when you think about the enormity of what this film has meant, not just domestically, you know, for all of us, but internationally and globally, it's an incredible effect.
Rolando, I want to talk about reissues as well, too, because Top Gun Maverick came back to the theaters. We're right on the edge of Spider-Man No Way Home coming back to the theaters. And I wore this Jaws shirt because this seminal classic came back to premium formats and screened in IMAX. How has the reception been to some of these movies coming back, and how important is that to the industry?
You know, I think it's let me answer the second part first, and very important to the industry. I think that there is a nostalgic effect that was really created through the course of COVID, right? If you think about through the COVID time period, while the film companies were not releasing their new films, they were releasing their library films and nostalgic. And so that element really brought an energy into the consumer base that basically said, oh my God, it's time for my kids to watch this movie. It's time for the younger generation to see what led up to some of these sequels down the line. So I think, you know, and I think about your t-shirt, right, of Jaws, and I'm thinking about, this was another movie that, my God, I remember after watching it the first time, I'm thinking, I'm not going to the beach anytime soon at that time. But you know, and so you think about, you know, the rippling effect of many of the films that have followed that or have been offshoots of Jaws and how well they've done. It's great to see. So very important to the industry. It's nice to see those coming in. And by the way, Sean, those happen to be what we would call great introduction into time periods that are fairly slow in some of the additional films that are coming out. So if you think about the next, you know, 4 to 5 weeks, there are films coming out every week, which is great news. And certainly considering COVID, what we dealt with then. But it's also nice to see those nostalgic films that kind of fill some of those gaps to bring in some of the different genres.
Well, you hear people talk about these films that they love, too, that just because of when they were born, necessarily, they never got an opportunity to see them on the big screen. And so even something like Avatar, which is preparing to come back, you know, there are a lot of people who caught up with that film after the fact. When James Cameron designed that film for the big screen, he designed it for 3D. And so to give them that opportunity, I think, is extremely special.
Well, and thank you for mentioning that, because, again, when you think about an Avatar, and you just said it right on the mark, it was a movie that was made for the big screen, right? And you had to see it in 3D. And by the way, it was an incredible launch of 3D at that point in time when it first came out and what it meant for that particular format. I think you're going to see the same thing again, you know, with the new Avatar. But by the way, with the re-release of Avatar, I think that's going to be very exciting for consumers to experience that again, in particular, the younger generation, right? That, by the way, faced the same thing with a movie like Top Gun. There were a lot of them that had not seen the first Top Gun, right? And so they had to go out and see it again, in some cases in the small screen, and then get the full effect. And then they showed up to see Top Gun 2 and they go, oh my God, this is pretty spectacular. And I think you're going to see the same thing with Avatar. So I'm glad to see what Disney's doing, that they're re-releasing the film. And that's going to create certainly not only a historic nature, but introduction to consumers that never really experienced it. And the lead in into the new Avatar, which, by the way, it's going to be an epic. I think that film's going to be spectacular.
James Cameron is another person we don't bet against at the box office.
You never bet against James Cameron. I think the man is an absolute genius, and it's going to be an incredible film.
So we're thrilled to have you on Real Blend to talk about a very specific initiative that's called National Cinema Day. What can you tell us about this?
Look, this is very exciting, first of all, Sean, and I think it's at a time period which is just made for this, right? When you think about the next couple of weeks, as I mentioned earlier, there's going to be films that are coming out, but you're starting to see a little bit of the energy settling because, you know, everybody's going back to school. You don't have the big blockbuster film that's opening up, but there's going to be some great adult films, some great, you know, stories that are coming out that don't necessarily always get the attention that they need. And so when you think about the fact that for the first time, we're going to have over 3,000 theaters, over 30,000 screens that are coming together to have a cinema day on Saturday, September 3rd, to celebrate just going to the movies. I mean, when you know, this doesn't even happen at the Academy Awards. You know, at the Academy Awards, we always tell them, you need to mention watching these films in movie theaters, which is very exciting. And they're a great group. And every once in a while, you hear that mentioned. But for the first time, we're actually really celebrating as an industry movie going and movie going in the movie theaters, you know, that we have a tremendous rippling effect into the economy of many people, right? Not just the employees that participate in our industry, but frankly, the consumer base, the main streets that we support, the rippling effect into the business surrounding us, the vendor communities that we support. So the fact that we're getting behind this, I think it's going to be very exciting. Think about this. The first time we have ever done this in the United States. This has been done in European countries and it's been extremely successful. But for the first time in the U.S., this is going to be very exciting for us.
Am I right that this National Cinema Day also addresses a concern that we hear often, which is just that the, you know, movie theaters can be really expensive nowadays. And am I paying to bring my entire family? How is National Cinema Day going to address that concern?
Look, I think that, first of all, we want to thank our partners in the film community because they were partners in this, and they're helping us with the celebration of this incredible day. And what that means is that, you know, theaters will be able to, basically our pricing structure will be up to $3. And so for the majority of and just think about this, every movie, every format, all formats will be $3, you know? And so what an exciting opportunity to not just celebrate movie going, but frankly, at an incredible price, value orientation for all consumers to come back and see not only fantastic films that have been playing for a long period of time and coming out of the summer, but these new films that I was talking about that are finding their way in these weeks where, you know, people don't necessarily pay as much attention, but they're fabulous stories to actually see.
Yeah, I can actually recommend there's a couple of horror films, The Invitation and Barbarian, which will be waiting for people at those times. And those are movies that are going to be part of the conversation because of some twists that are involved in them that you're going to want to be there entry level and not get spoiled on what happens in them.
Absolutely. And look, I think that you're also going to see a lot of theater operators that will be offering, you know, in addition to that, there's many of them that are going to be doing concession offerings as part of this, you know, to really celebrate the idea. This is not about, you know, driving large sums of money through the door. This is about a celebration about movie going, attending the movies, getting them back into the theaters, and remind everybody that, listen, we are a great social experience. When you're sitting around in a room with another 150 or 200 customers that you don't even know, and you're experiencing that laughter on the screen or that emotion, you know, together, it's you know, it's very impactful. And I think that's what we create. We help create memories.
No, definitely. One of the things that we always stress when we get, we have directors come on the show often, and they talk about designing their pictures for the big screen, especially someone like a Jordan Peele, who's working in IMAX. And when he goes into those aspect ratio shifts, it's always for a narrative reason. And if you're watching it in any other format, you're just not getting the full experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, I think that it's hard to replicate. In fact, I know I'm a little biased, but it's impossible to replicate the theatrical experience in your living room, right? And especially when you're watching not only epic films, which are very important, but frankly, great stories. You know, when I think about a film like Where the Crawdads Sing, right, that was very impactful, and watching it with other people and the emotions that we experienced together in the theater, it's hard to duplicate that in your house.
Very true. Okay, so between now and the end of the year, Rolando, what are you really excited for at Marcus Theaters? What can our readers be, or our listeners be looking out for?
Look, I think that the slate looks very good, actually. And I think, you know, as I said, the next 4 or 5 weeks, there's very good films that people should be looking out, smaller stories. But look, starting in October, you got Lyle Crocodile. And I don't know if you've seen the trailer on that, but it's going to be a very fun and funny an exciting movie for consumers. Then you got a couple of very big films that are coming out. You got Black Adam that you need to keep an eye on, right? That's The Rock, and you don't bet against The Rock either. And so, and then by the way, you got, you know, in my mind, a very exciting one in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. I mean, everybody wants to know how that story turns out. What's the next evolution of it? I think it's going to be very exciting. And then the end of the year, you got Puss in Boots, and you got, you know, an incredible Avatar 2 that's coming out. So look, a lot of fun films, a lot of exciting films. So we think that beginning the first part of October, all the way through the end of the year, there's going to be some really exciting films for all consumers to enjoy. Come and see them, not just at Marcus Theaters, but all theaters across the U.S., which we need you to participate in.
All right, we're going to end it right there, Rolando. That's perfect. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Sean, thank you. And thank you for what you're doing about our industry. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to Rolando for joining us. And just a reminder, if you guys are heading out to the theaters, look out for National Cinema Day. Participating theaters are going to have tickets that are at maximum $3. And so if you've been looking for an excuse to get out to the theaters and maybe check out Top Gun Maverick or Jurassic World Dominion or some of the movies we're going to talk about in this week in movies is about
Spider-Man
reissues. Dude, I'm going to go see Spider-Man No Way Home.
You know they're saying that Top Gun could take the top spot at the box office this weekend.
Insane. That's insane.
I really hope that happens. I hope Top Gun beats Spider-Man.
I hope so. No, I hope so, too. Oh, dude, I went and looked for tickets for Spider-Man on Thursday, and the majority of the theaters around me have like one ticket sold. Or three tickets sold. Like, I just don't think that people are in, like, I can't wait to go back and see it on the big screen. I just want to see it big again. But either Sony's not promoting it or people don't want to they don't want to watch it again. It's on Blu-ray. They can watch it at home. So I don't know. You know what else they can watch at home, guys? Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, which is coming to Amazon Studios. The first two episodes are they dropping two right off the
first
bat?
Two.
Okay,
first two.
We've all managed to see two. And by now, when you guys have listened to this on August 31st, they did a fan event where the first two episodes were available on the big screen, which I thought was a very cool thing for them to do, because the predominant thought that I had while watching the first two episodes were, damn, I would love to watch this on the big screen.
Yeah.
Because Kev, is this the one you were talking about? Because I watched it in a similar fashion. I was able to get it onto my television set at least.
Yeah,
but it was watermarked, and so my name is blasted across it. And even at that, I thought it was really beautiful. And so I'm going to shock everybody, because if you've listened to this show at all from day one, you know that I don't care for the Lord of the Rings
movies. Which makes no sense what you're about to say.
But I enjoyed. I don't get two episodes.
That makes no sense.
I found that the pacing of these shows were better. It was more brisk. It moved along there are a lot of storylines going on. If anything, it might be a little bit confusing, but I did have an easier time sort of following. And I know that they talked about some of the color palette shifting, but I just found the characters to be, although now I found out today that the main girl, the main blonde girl, Galadriel,
young Cate Blanchett,
had no idea. No clue that was her character at a young age.
And then the one guy is a young Hugo Weaving.
Mm-hmm. And that actor also plays a younger Ned Stark.
Okay.
In Game of Thrones.
No idea. Yeah. So I'm not invested to that level, but I am really interested so far in the things that they are laying out. It is an interesting story in the fact that it's set during a time of alleged peace, but the threat of Sauron is coming. And it's how all these different characters are reacting to it. And dude, I don't know. I can't tell you why I connected with it in a way that I didn't.
Makes me happy.
Is there a chance that if you like, let's say you love this series, will that change your appreciation for? Well, I wouldn't say appreciation. I think you appreciate the Lord of the Rings films, but your thoughts on Lord of the Rings?
No, because I've gone back and tried to watch Lord of the Rings.
What you're saying is someone needs to make a Forrest Gump the series.
Let me ask a question for legitimately. You guys love the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yes.
It feels like the delivery of the dialogue is a little bit more accessible. Have they watered down the Tolkien-ness of it? Because I feel like watching characters have conversations in these episodes is a little bit easier to follow than
it's not as well written.
Yeah, I would disagree in that whenever I heard how they speak and how they there's certain turns of phrase and the word placement. If anything, it reminded me, oh, that's right. That is how they speak in Lord of the Rings. Like if anything, it threw me back to, because Game of Thrones, you know, and the reason I'm comparing it to Game of Thrones is because at this point we've seen the first two Game of Thrones. I'm sorry. Not Game of Thrones. House of the Dragon. Yeah. And they're two massive fantasy series dropping at the same time. Yeah. But House of the Dragon still speaks. Now, every once in a while, you know, there'll be flashes of old English, but still slips into like kind of modern, like, you know, fuck you. No, fuck you. Kind of, you know, as opposed to Lord of the Rings is very much old classic Tolkien English. Okay. So, no, it didn't strike me as different at all.
Interesting. OK, I have no explanation as to why, but I was as stunned as you guys. That when I watched the first episode in preparation for the junket, and I planned to only watch the first episode. And when I got to the end of that episode, be it for whatever happens, because I won't talk about what it is, but I immediately wanted to go in to watch the second one because I was interested and not because I was like, this is homework. I got to figure out some questions to ask for these people. So I'm in and we'll see how long it holds my interest. So
I mean, for me, and we've discussed this in the show before, I did not read the Lord of the Rings books. So my entry into the Lord of the Rings world is Peter Jackson. And I still think those are three of the greatest movies I've ever seen in my life. They were films that just took me to a world that I'd never experienced anything on that scale, with those visual effects and the practical nature of it, and just the sweeping shots and Howard Shore's score. And Howard Shore came back and did the main title theme for this, but is it Bear McCreary, I believe, is the gentleman's name.
Oh, he's really talented. He's a good
who does the music composer for the show. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, all right. So, I mean, I gotta be completely honest. I watched this on a laptop. So yeah. And I'm not saying that is a reason for me not to go into full critical mode here. I just don't feel like I saw it properly. Mm. I thought it was fine. I didn't think I thought the story was fine. I didn't find anything to be like mind blowing. But at the same time, I appreciated being back in that world. It just kept reminding me why that I wanted to rewatch Jackson's movies. Mm. It just kept reminding me of how much I love those films. And there is a big difference between shooting digitally and film. Like, there's something about Jackson's movies that just look gritty and like dark and dirty, and like they feel almost indie like, but they're on a massive scale. I think, yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I guess I would compare it to Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, right? So like, you love Breaking Bad, and then Better Call Saul is leading us into the events of Breaking Bad. And I think that Better Call Saul was a necessary show and made Breaking Bad better. Mm. The two episodes I've seen of Rings of Power just felt that they didn't, to me, add anything for me personally that I needed.
Are you going to stick with it?
I'll stick with it just because I actually want to actively watch it on my TV.
Okay.
And again, I'm not saying that the quality will jump up for me, but like, at the same time, I watched it with a gigantic watermark across the screen with my email address on it. Yeah. And this is a visually stunning show, you know, and they spent a lot of money. I think it's the most expensive series in the history of television.
I think the money's there. It shows.
It's there. And the shots are great. I just don't really remember much about those two episodes. And I watched them a couple weeks ago. I don't really remember really what happened. I mean, I remember watching them going, this is good. But, you know, it didn't blow my mind. But I also didn't properly watch it on a screen, so I don't know yet. So I'm just going to stick to that for now. And once I do watch it, because I will, because I'm a huge fan of Lord of the Rings, then I'll continue on. But we'll see.
Jackie?
I actually really love the show. I was able to watch both episodes on my TV. I was able to get it on my TV and actually watch each episode twice. I think that it's, to me, looks and feels like it perfectly fits right in with Jackson's trilogy. And I adamantly hate the Hobbit trilogy, so I'm talking about the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I think it genuinely looks
I just feel like
an incredible accomplishment in television. Like, I was sitting there watching so many different moments, and it felt like I missed seeing something on the big screen and was seeing it on TV for the first time. And I had to keep reminding myself, no, this is not a big screen. I'm watching something made for TV that looks like it should be a major Christmas blockbuster.
Watching that, watching Lord of the Rings and watching Game of Thrones, within a week span, I was like, I think I texted you this. I was like, the line between made for television and made for movie,
it's ridiculous,
is just gone.
Yeah.
I mean, if they want to disagree with that. Well, but if they want to,
I think Rings of Power feels like a TV show. It just does.
That's interesting.
I thought Game of Thrones felt like a TV show.
Watch it bigger. You got to watch it bigger.
No, I thought Game of Thrones felt like a TV show. Breaking Bad feels like a TV show. No, that is not a bad thing, though. Like a television episodic storyline is very different from a 2.5-hour arc shoved into a film. Like,
it is.
These movies, these shows are breathing. Like, they're taking a lot of time. To me, they don't feel like movies. Like, Breaking Bad was probably the closest thing I've ever felt to watching.
Having watched those two Rings episodes back to back, felt like I was watching a Lord of the Rings movie. I'm super into it.
Quality?
I mean, that's unfair to say because Jackson is like what Jackson. But like, to me, it felt. Here's what I'll say. To me, the Rings of Power fits more comfortably in with the Lord of the Rings trilogy than Jackson's Hobbit trilogy fits in with Lord of the Rings. Wow. It fits. It feels like it belongs more so. That being said, it's whether it's a fair or unfair comparison, just because two major fantasy series drop at the same time, and I've seen the first two episodes of each. Yeah. I am more excited about progressing in House of the Dragon than I am Rings of Power. That being said, it is possible in the same way that I believe that you can love Marvel and DC at the same time. We don't have to pick and choose. Like, just I know exactly. But I'm just happy. And also, I like to per Gabe's suggestion, I'm also in love with Sandman. So we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to fantasy television. Three massive, beautiful pieces of fantasy work at our streaming fingertips. It's a beautiful time.
Did you finish Sandman yet? Or are you?
No, I'm going to, because you mentioned to me that those last four are kind of their own encompassing thing. Yeah. So I'm going to blow through those collectively, because honestly, after the diner episode and the walk with death, those touched me, honestly, not to like be dramatic, but those touched me so deeply that I kind of just wanted to just sit on them for a little bit.
Do you ever find out why he goes off to Neverland?
Yeah. I was wondering, when do they enter Sandman? Like when is that? Like, is it
opening scene and Sandman enters?
I was just curious, like his head. I was wondering, does Hetfield like tee it up?
It's Netflix. It's Netflix. So there's even a Stranger Things tie-in for the Metallica.
And then the end of the season, Hubie shows up, and it's like they tie the whole Netflix universe.
I'm waiting on the Netflix MCU.
That's in Sandler's contract. Every Netflix property has to end with Hubie showing up.
Neil Gaiman shows up and he's just vomiting on a bike.
All right, this week in movies, there's a couple of old ones coming back to theaters as reissues. Spider-Man No Way Home is getting a re-release with 11 additional minutes. Nothing significant from what I understand. You'll get another Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock scene.
Different post-credit scene?
A different post-credit scene, which I watched on YouTube today.
Oh, I was asking with a question mark. There is.
There is. Because
what is it?
You remember previously they did the...
It was a Doctor Strange trailer.
The Doctor Strange trailer, yes.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. I won't reveal what it is.
Text me.
It's spoilery.
I'm not going to go see it.
I am going to go see it. I'm definitely going to see it.
Did they find a way home this time though in this version?
Wait, we're all going to see old movies this weekend. You're going to see that. Way. Kevin's going to see Jaws, and I'm going to go see The Shining.
Yes, you are.
That's pretty good.
Oh, look at us not seeing new movies when they come out, but going out of our way to see movies that came out 40 years ago.
So Jaws is going to be on IMAX and also available in 3D. So I think it's available in both of those formats.
Blasphemy. Jaws 3 should be the only one in 3D.
Which Jaws?
Weirdly enough, they're re-releasing Jaws 3D in 2D for some reason.
Which Jaws is the one where like the people are in that like that museum water tunnel and like the shark comes?
That's
3D.
That scene was terrifying, man. That scene scared me.
Wasn't it like the son of Jaws or like was like coming after?
It was the mayor. It was the mayor's son. Yeah.
It's Luke Gossett Jr.'s in that one as well, too.
And Michael Caine's in 4.
Michael Caine is in 4. Yes.
Michael Caine.
And then there's a movie called Honk for Jesus, Save Your Soul, which I think Jake saw. Jake?
Yes. Kevin and I both saw it.
Oh, you both did?
Yeah. I actively dislike this film. Oh. It is sort of a... it's kind of a mockumentary in the vein of like a Spinal Tap, where a documentary crew is following sort of this pastor of this mega ultra massive Baptist church. Think like a Joel Osteen, or a Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, and Regina Hall is his wife. So they kind of have the Jim and Tammy Faye Baker relationship. The idea being that he messed up, he did something bad, and is trying to earn back his giant crowds. And he thinks that if he gets a documentary crew to follow him around, that it'll make. I do think Sterling K. Brown and Regina are very charming. I just think that these two characters, I think, are just, I didn't enjoy spending time with them. I didn't enjoy either of these characters. I don't think either of them are particularly good people, and neither of them ever really had any roundabout redeemable qualities. The reveal, I mean, I think the movie has a lot to say about that world and the world of religion and the hypocrisy that follows a lot of it. I almost wish it had the guts to say a little bit more. I almost wished if you were going to jump into the pool, you were going to go into the deep end, and it kind of just floats around somewhere in the middle. But I just found the characters and just the plot itself just not enjoyable experience to watch. And it just didn't work for me, despite the fact that I really do like Sterling and Regina.
Have you going to defend it?
I really liked it. I thought it was really well done. I thought Regina and Sterling K. Brown were awesome in the movie. And I actually thought her character was very redeemable. I thought she was a great character. And she was this film is being billed as a comedy. But I also think it's a very tragic story as well, about this idea of the person that we put out into the world versus who we really are, and the perception of how people take us in versus the person we may be. And I found it was really cool how they play with the aspect ratio of this movie as well, because the film has basically two different aspect ratios. So the world of the movie that you're in when you're watching the movie is widescreen. But then when you go into the documentary footage, you go into like this 1.66:4:3 format with the black bars in the left and the right. So that becomes a subconscious or a conscious way for you to differentiate between the movie they're making in the movie and the movie that you're watching. And it's really kind of a cool thing to see. Like I thought it was funny when you'd be in the middle of the film and then they would jump into the documentary and they would come back to real life. And then the differences in how they would act in each of those scenarios for the cameras was really, really interesting. I thought Sterling K. Brown, his performance is incredible. Like, I thought him and Regina were great together. This is produced by Jordan Peele and Daniel Kaluuya. And this is the Monkey Paw Productions. You'll see that logo at the beginning of the film. I do think that one thing that Jake said, I think I do agree with, is like they maybe could have taken a couple more deeper jabs at some of the things they were discussing. But to me, the church and the religion aspect of it, to me, really isn't even really the point of the movie. This is the way I took it. I took it more of a movie about being who you are and being true to yourself and that's the way I took it. And again,
no, I agree with there are a lot of aspects about that. I think my issue with it is that a lot of what you're talking about, without getting into spoilers, a lot of these personal deep rooted revelations, I think, come around the second act. But I think my biggest issue is that they spend so much of the first act and it's a funny way or not, like giving us examples of how neither of them are particularly great people. I mean, we're talking about people that spend massive amounts of the church money on cars and high end clothes. And, you know, so much of Regina's character, at least off the top, is about preserving so much of their relationship and her husband's image selfishly for herself. And so by the time these personal revelations come along, for me, it was just a little bit too late, because it's just like, OK, yes, I get what you're saying about like who they are as people. But you just spent 30 minutes giving me so many examples about why these people deep down really aren't that great. So I don't give a shit about your personal revelations, because you're spending the church's money on high-end Prada suits and bragging about the Prada suits and bragging about your Lamborghinis. And so I don't really give a shit about what it is you're going through.
I completely saw that differently. I saw it as the people that we met in the beginning of the film were in a mindset where they didn't really understand kind of what they were doing, right? And I think my personal opinion,
that's also one of the big issues I had with the Baker movie, is that like I don't necessarily think that Tammy Faye was innocent in that whole situation. I had the same issue with both films, is what I'm saying.
Let me clarify. I'm not saying these characters are innocent. I'm saying that they are so in their heads about what they're doing that they're just moving through life without really any empathy about what they're actually doing, right? But the point that I'm making is, as the film unravels and you watch Regina Hall's character kind of go through her arc is the point of the film, which is literally this idea of like coming to a realization of what they were actually doing wrong. And in my opinion, Sterling K. Brown, like that's his whole storyline. We could dive into that later if we ever get back to this film. But I think the film is, yes, it's commenting on that style of mega church and like using the money for things you shouldn't be using it for, etc. I completely agree that that's all in there. But I feel like these characters are much deeper than that. And I actually believe the arc. I think that Regina was her character specifically, I found her to be redeemable at the end, very redeemable, and I felt for her. And so I think there's a lot in that movie that it's not this satirical comedy it's being pushed as. It's I thought it was super tragic in my personal opinion. And, but also this is, again, anybody who watches this film comes from different perspectives. Like, you know, if you're, if you know about the Joel Osteen stuff, whatever like that, like I'm, you know, I just was more in, I was more involved in it from a character standpoint than I was about the church aspect of it, if that makes sense.
So let's see, did you choose this for your hashtag Regina Hall blend pick? Because we're playing Regina Hall blend for our game this week. Kev, kick us off.
I do think she's great in it. My favorite thing she's ever done is Scary Movie.
I also pick Scary Movie.
Did you?
Just,
all right.
Just because, like, I remember, well, first of all, Scary Movie, the spoof genre, if you want to call it that, you know, I loved Scream so much. And to, like, see an R-rated version of that in a comedic spin. But Regina's performance in that, and again, this goes back to everything I've been saying for years about comedy. Like, Scary Movie will never be looked at as a quality picture. And I'm not saying it needs to be, but I am saying that the performances in that film, especially from Regina Hall, are incredible. But they're never going to be taken seriously. And it's funny because, like, I always joke that I love Not Another Teen Movie. You know, it's a raunchy spoof. That movie is really well written in terms of, like, the jokes that it's making and the world that it's building. And, you know, obviously some of the things in those, these movies are not appropriate anymore. But at the same time, I don't know. I just remember Regina. That was my
that
first
scene with her. Is it Mike Epps? No, it's not Mike Epps.
You're talking about the movie theater?
Who's in Scary Movie with her? Yeah.
Well, Omar Epps is in
Omar Epps.
Epps
is in Scream 2.
That's the scene they're making fun of.
So in Scream,
it's 2, Marlon Wayans.
Right. So it's Omar Epps and Regina. I'm sorry. Okay. Scream 2 is Omar Epps and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yeah.
Scary Movie 2 is Regina Hall and I believe
Marlon Wayans.
Sean.
Sean's the one that gets the dick in the ear.
Right, because isn't he dating Regina Hall's character?
That sounds right.
I don't know. I haven't seen it forever, but please, whoever runs that out of context, please use that line.
Let me double check this. Because,
but also make sure that you use the correct spelling of Sean. Otherwise,
not me. Well, anyway, Jake, go ahead. You keep going.
I picked Scary Movie as well. That's a movie that, like,
okay, I just want to clarify it. We are right. Just to clarify, in Scream 2, Jada and Omar Epps, and then the scene they're making fun of in Scary Movie 2 ends up being Regina Hall and Sean Wayans because they're dating in the film. That's right. Yeah. But it is confusing because you think of the Scream 2 scene.
I got confused. Like,
yeah. All right.
Yeah, I picked Scary Movie. There are, it's been 20 years since that movie came out. It's probably been 15 since I've seen it. There are a lot of things that I laughed at whenever I was 12 years old and thought it was the funniest thing in the world. I've seen a handful of clips here and there 20 years later that don't make me laugh like they used to. There's a lot of like, oh, that's right, that was funny 20 years ago, but it's not really. But her stuff, to me, still makes me laugh out loud. And
she's
what I appreciate
Shakespeare
about
in Love, right?
Yeah, she sings Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
But what I love about her character Brenda isn't so much that, like, she's endured 20 years and still is probably the funniest part of that movie, but she seems to have a great appreciation for that character. Like, she was just recently in my studio with Sterling for Honk for Jesus, and I had planned on showing the clip of her in the movie theater where she's commentating on Shakespeare in Love. And a lot of people in my studio were like, how are you going to, like, transition to that? How are you going to, like, casually bring up this character? And she brought her up, like, in a very loving, like, talking about Brenda. I was like, oh, awesome. Like, that's so the fact that, like, she still loves that. And I know that I saw a few other people's interviews where she brought her up as well. So, like, she still seems to have an appreciation and affinity for that character, which in turn makes me still love that character even more. So, again, I don't necessarily super love that movie as much as I did when I was, like, 12 years old. But I love her in that movie, and I think any aspect of comedy that can last 20 years, 25 years, particularly when it was from the early 2000s, when a lot of questionable comedies came from, and still be funny, I think thumbs up to that.
All right. You guys went comedy. I wanted to go drama. I wanted to call out her performance and the film in general, The Hate U Give.
Yes, love that movie.
incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
I went into that movie expecting it to be powerful, and it was so much more effective than even I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Not just for her, although she's terrific in it, but for Amanda Stenberg also, who really stood out and caught my eye. And it tackled, you know, a really difficult topic of police shootings at a time when that story was everywhere in the news. And it felt like that movie was hitting at the exact right time to comment on it. Terrible, you know, that it has to come out at a time when that story is so relevant and in the news. But the movie doesn't pull any punches. The cast commits to it completely, asks the really difficult questions that have to be asked in a story like that. And I just looking over Regina's filmography, she's done a lot of comedies, and we're going to see when we get to the audience picks that a lot of people do go for her funny stuff because she's an extremely gifted comedian. The other one I might have gone with was Girls Trip, where I just think she has great chemistry with everybody in that cast.
Girls Trip is incredible.
So funny.
That movie is so funny. Like, genuinely one of the funniest movies I've seen in years.
But The Hate U Give just felt so contemporary and so important when it came out. And I thought everybody was really operating on a different level in that one. So I wanted to give credit to her and choose that one. Damien McDonald, talking about our audience picks, also went with The Hate U Give. John Palmer said Death at a Funeral. Ariel Pace went with The Honeymooners. And then a ton of people joined you guys with Scary Movie. Kim and Zen Jake and Jose Munez and many, many others went with Scary
Munoz,
Movie.
Munoz.
Munoz. What did I say? Munez?
Munez.
Munez, like Frankie Munez?
Yes.
Which is the one that has the priest taking a dump on the toilet?
That's
Scary Movie 2.
That's James Woods. When he says that, he shows up to the house and he goes, I must release these demons. And then he goes in the bathroom and then the flies are all flying around. He goes, ah, those enchiladas. Like, that's one of my favorite. Man, I love that scene.
My favorite part of that scene is right before when he basically represents all people in this situation, where he walks into the room with Reagan, quote unquote, who her head spins around, and he just goes, that's fuck after this, and walks out.
I feel like I need to rewatch those.
So when he says those enchiladas, I want to just spend like 30 seconds on this, because you guys think I'm joking, but the delivery of that line is brilliant. Like let me tell you why. Like, he's on that toilet and he, you know, he has his explosion or whatever, and then the best part about it is, like, he comes that, like, you see it on his eyes, you see him come to the realization, he goes, oh yeah, those enchiladas. it's just such a great it's a realization.
Thank you, James Lipton, for breaking down the approach into the exciting scene. All right, James, next week.
James Woods, man. Wow.
Reach out to us on Twitter using hashtag John Boyega Blend. We're going to discuss the films of John Boyega. So let us know your pick on social media, or you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. That is also where you can, guys, leave us a review if you would like to. We'll read it here on the show. You can head over to Apple Podcasts or even to Spotify, and you can leave us a rating and then a review over there. Our next premium episode, as I mentioned, is going to be the box office game, which is a lot of fun. So to make sure that you are getting all your bonus episodes dropped on Monday, check the description here where you can learn how to sign up for Real Blend Premium. In the meantime, follow us on social media. Jake Hamilton is at Jake's Takes. Kevin McCarthy TV for your boy K-Mac. I'm at Sean_O'Connell. Gabe is at Gabe Kovach. And the show is at Real Blend. Again, reminder, guys, we're not here next week, but you will have an hour plus episode with Kevin Smith. And then we'll be back with some updates from Toronto and D23 and all the other fun stuff coming this fall. So until then.
Those enchiladas.
Those enchiladas.
Fuck this. That's the new one.